Jonah Berger is back on the show with me today. He's a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business. I had the pleasure of talking to him 3 years ago when he published a book called Contagious, Why Things Catch On. And now he's back with a follow-up called Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. Jonah, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Before I read your book, I'll be honest, I thought that as an adult who's been on this earth for a few decades, every day I was making informed decisions on my own of everything I buy and everything I consume and everything I read and everything I watch. And now I realize after reading your book, I was lying to myself for a long time. I don't actually make those decisions. People are influencing them, and I don't have free will, Jonah.
It's kind of interesting, and I think some people are a little bit scared by it, but I think most folks are interested by it. You know, we think we make our choices, from the simple, like what breakfast cereal to buy, to the profound, like who to marry or what careers to pursue, and yet we don't. The folks around us, you know, everything from our family members and our friends, which I think we understand a little bit about, to strangers and the person next to us on the bus or the person running on the treadmill next to us at the gym, have a significant and often subtle impact on how we behave. And so the book is all about how we can understand that impact and how we can use that science by understanding it to live happier and healthier lives.
Yeah, well, I want to get to the how do we use it part a little bit later. But first, I've got to just say, you know, you talked about the treadmill. I'm a swimmer. And so when I'm doing laps, I notice that if the person next to me is slower than I am, I feel good about that, even though I'm not in a race with them. There's nothing on the line. But if the person next to me is somebody who's in better shape and swims faster, now I have to swim faster because that competitive gene kicks in and I'm being influenced by these people who I don't even know.
Yeah, it's so funny you mentioned that. I just was going for a swim right before we chatted, and there was no one in the pool. It was empty, middle of the day, no one was there, and I kind of didn't feel real motivated. Yet other times I go swimming, and I feel super motivated, and part of the reason is are other people around. Even if they're in the lane next to us, but even if they're not, even if they're just other people there watching us, the mere fact that others are present can have a powerful motivating force encouraging us to do better.
In fact, you've got a couple of examples in this book, several of them, in fact, about how being observed changes people's behavior. And one of my favorites is the one where you're simply asked to compare a line with three other lines. Can you explain that experiment to my audience?
Sure. So this is a great old classic psychology experiment. Imagine you come to a room and you're seated around a table with about, you know, five or six other people that are kind of the same age as you. And you're told that you're going to look at lines. It's a judgment of visual acuity. You're going to look at lines. And they're going to give you three lines, and they're going to ask you which of them is the same length as a fourth line. And so there'll be a small line, a medium line, and a longer line. Which of the three is the same as a fourth line that is either small, medium, or long? It's really easy task. Yet when you start, you're the last around the table. The answer is obviously A. When you look at it, the fourth line is the short line, so it's obviously A, the short of the other three. But the first person looks at the lines for a minute and goes, you know what, the answer is B. And the next person goes, the answer is B. The next person goes, the answer is B. And they all say B, and then it gets to you. And you're sitting there going, God, my eyes are telling me it's A. Yet all these other people said B.
Yeah.
Maybe it's actually B. Social influence has these two effects there. You know, one is with information. Others maybe give us information about the right thing or the wrong thing to do. What's interesting here is there's no information, right? Your eyes tell you all that information. But there's also that social pressure. You know, it's like being out to dinner with a group of friends, and you're planning on getting dessert, and the waiter comes by and asks what you want, and everyone else turns down the dessert, and then it gets to you. You want dessert. You're excited about dessert, but maybe you say no because no one else is getting dessert.
Yeah, but
the same thing here.
I would add that in the dessert case, it might be that you just don't want to hold everybody else up and keep them at the table all sitting around watching you eat dessert. But in the case of the lines, that's an unbelievable amount of social pressure, which can lead to all sorts of problems.
Definitely. And we're all familiar with some of the downsides of social influence. Groupthink, where we all end up going along with the group when we shouldn't, or other cases where people make bad decisions because they just follow others. But, you know, it's important to remember that others often help us make better decisions. Think about if you had to figure out what mechanic to use or what restaurant to try without asking anyone else. Life would be a lot tougher and a lot more time consuming. And so influence not only hurts, often it can help.
You know, it's funny, speaking of the dessert, favorites, and you mentioned restaurants again. If I go to a restaurant with my mom and my wife and my daughter and maybe other people, my mom will always order last. She has to find out before anybody orders, what are you having? What are you having? Then she'll look back at the menu. What are you having? What are you having? She has to find out from every other person what they're having before she will decide what she's going to have. Even though I know if you just handed her that menu, just like in the line test, if you handed somebody that question individually with nobody else around, they're perfectly capable of coming up with the correct answer or the food that they want to order, but they don't. What is that about?
Yeah, it's interesting. In those cases, you know, sometimes we go along with the group, but just as often we do something different. And, you know, in the case of your mom, I'm not sure if that's the case, but, you know, many of us, when we're at dinner, if we're the last one to order and someone else picks off what we were planning on getting,
Yeah. Well,
we don't order that thing anymore. We switch our order to get something else.
Oh, you're going to have the sesame chicken.
It isn't just about doing the same thing. Sometimes it's about doing something different.
Oh, I was going to get the sesame chicken, but since you got it, I'll get the beef with broccoli.
Exactly, and we end up being less satisfied as a result because we really wanted the sesame chicken, but because we switched our choice, now we're dissatisfied.
Okay, so tell me how we can use these tactics to influence others, because, you know, I've got listeners right now who might have to go into the boss and ask for a raise, or might be applying for a job, or negotiating to buy a car. Can you use the tactics that are in your book for those things?
Certainly. You know, I was telling my cousin about the book, and he was actually in the middle of a tough salary negotiation at the office. They were giving him a new job, but they weren't giving him much more money. And so he applied a trick in the book, and it totally worked for him. But researchers were looking at what makes negotiators successful, why some people succeed and others fail. They found one trick led negotiators five times as likely to reach a successful outcome. And that trick, very simply, was mimicking their negotiating partner, mirroring the language and behavior of that person. So that person crosses their legs, you do the same. If that person touches their cheek or leans their head to the side, subtly, you do the same. You don't do exactly what they're doing all the time, and you don't do it obviously, but subtly mimicking them led them five times as likely to reach a deal. Same thing in a restaurant context. If a waiter or waitress mimics your order word for word, they get a 70% higher tip. And so mimicry is a powerful way to create trust, create liking, and deepen social relationships.
Wow. All right, so then what about the impact of social media when people like you on Facebook or retweet something that you've put on Twitter? Does that apply in the same way?
You know, that's not exactly the same in terms of mimicry. Mimicry is a little more of imitation. You know, imagine you and I found that we went to the same high school many years ago, or that we actually have the same birthday. We feel a kinship, kind of like we're part of the same tribe. And so we trust each other more, we like each other more. And if you asked me to do you a favor, I'd be more likely to say yes. Mimicry is the same thing. It's about subtly mimicking the language, the mannerisms, or the behavior of others. You know, politicians do it when they travel around the country using different sort of twangs or accents depending on the areas they are. And we can adopt the same thing. You know, in an email, if someone says dear rather than hi, using that same strategy at the beginning of the email will get them to like us more.
Interesting. Jonah Berger is the author of Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. You also say in the book that if you're coming out with a new product and you want people to like it, it has to be different, but not too different.
Yeah, this was so interesting doing research on this particular topic. I think we all have this notion that difference leads to success, that companies like Apple and Google succeed because they're different. If you actually look at it, though, most of the products Apple and Google have been successful with, they weren't the first to market. They were actually the third or fourth or fifth. And so if difference didn't make them successful, what did? Well, it turns out it's all about being something called optimally distinct, or as you noted, similar but different at the same time. You know, if something is too different, it's often scary. People don't want to adopt it. They're not sure how they use it. But if it's too similar, they say, why do I need something new? Well, in between is just right. Just like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you know, too hot, too cold, in between is just right. Too similar, it's boring. Too new or sort of scary, people aren't going to adopt it. But in between, optimally distinct is just right.
Another area of research that you quote in the book is the tendency of NBA teams that are losing to continue to lose unless they're only losing a little bit at halftime. Explain that one.
Imagine you're watching an NBA game or an NCAA game on the TV. You're wondering who to bet on. It's halftime, the team's up, the team's down. Who should you bet on? We looked at tens of thousands of games, and we found that if you're betting, you should bet on the winning team. Teams that are winning at halftime are more likely to win than teams that are losing. The more points they're ahead at halftime, the more likely they are to win. But, and this is an important but, there's one place where losing is actually a good thing. If you're going to bet your money, you should actually bet on the losing team. And that's if the team is losing by just a little bit. If a team is losing by just a little, that team is actually more likely to win than the team that was ahead. And the reason why is completely psychological. Just like we're talking about the swimmers in different lanes noticing others, teams that are behind by just a little bit, they feel like they're so close they can almost taste it. If they work just a little bit harder, they'll be able to close that gap and win the game. And in fact, that's what they do. They come out of the locker room at halftime fired up, they work harder, and they're more likely to win as a result.
Have you actually put money on this?
I have a little bit, and I've won quite a little bit of money by using this trick.
Wow! Look at you, the sports betting tout! Okay, one other area of research, and I'm not going to go through the whole book, and it's full of this sort of stuff, but there's one other that really jumped out at me, and this is the Stanford Geek wristband test that you conducted. Tell people about that.
So a number of years ago, those yellow Livestrong bands were popular. People were wearing them around. So we sold them to a dorm on campus, and then we sold those same wristbands to the geeky dorm on campus, the academic-focused dorm, the folks that take lots of special classes and the like. And we found that when the geeks adopted it, the original folks, they stopped using it. Again, they didn't just do the same thing as others. The fact that the geeks were doing it made them less likely to want to adopt that particular wristband and, in fact, actually get rid of it when they had used it previously. And we see the same thing often, you know. If a band becomes too popular, some set of people stop liking it because it's gone mainstream.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if a certain group of people starts doing something we like, maybe we don't want to do it anymore. Abercrombie and Fitch actually offered to pay a character from the Jersey Shore money not to wear their clothes for this exact reason. They were worried that if he was wearing them, people like him would start wearing it, and the target market of Abercrombie wouldn't want to wear it anymore.
Well, I can tell you this. I'm not fashion-oriented in any way, but if somebody from the Jersey Shore, and I knew who that person was, and they started doing anything that I was doing, I would seriously think about stopping doing that. I think that's a pretty good bet right there. So, Jonah, you've been studying this subject for over a decade now. Are you yourself immune to these invisible influences? Do you recognize them and say, don't act on that?
You know, what I can say is that understanding influence has helped me make a lot better choices, but also sometimes it makes life more difficult. I'm terrible to shop with because I'm always thinking about how I'm being influenced and who is influencing me. So, but understanding these tools, seeing them in the world around us, can definitely help us make better choices and avoid bad ones.
But what if a bunch of people tell you, oh, you have to binge watch this show, it's great. Do you try it out and check it out for yourself, or do you go, well, I'm not going to be influenced by them?
You know, I definitely consider it, but I also consider, are those people similar to me or not? Too often we just assume if something's popular, we'll like it. But it depends on whether those people are like us or not. If their preferences are like ours, we'll probably like it. But if their preferences are different, we might actually not like it.
So I'm curious how this applies to the case of a jury. You know, 12 random people thrown together into a room and they've got to decide maybe a life and death case. Maybe it's not that important, but all sorts of things that they have to come to a unanimous decision on. Where does the invisible influence enter into the jury chamber?
These factors certainly play a role in jury decisions. You know, imagine you're sitting around in a table, you're not sure how to vote. The first few people vote a particular way. Just like that line study, that's going to change what answer you think is right and what answer you think is wrong. Mm. And so one thing I talk about in the group for making, in the book, for making better group decisions is to set up what I'll call a designated dissenter. Someone whose job it is to actually disagree with the group. Whatever the group is saying, not to go along and disagree. And the reason is twofold. One, they'll bring up some good points that the group may not have considered, and at least by seeing the other side of the argument, we'll make a better decision. But second, and more importantly, the mere fact that they've said they're disagreeing makes everyone else more comfortable to disagree from the group. The fact that there's one person disagreeing makes it no longer a right or wrong answer. It makes it a matter of opinion. And if it's a matter of opinion, people are more likely to share their own.
And all of a sudden, you've got Henry Fonda and 12 Angry Men.
Yeah, indeed.
The book is called Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior, from Wharton School of Business Marketing Professor Jonah Berger. Thanks so much for your time today. A pleasure talking to you again.
No problem. Great to talk to you as well.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.